The test is in four parts, part 1, part 2, part 3, and part 4. Now look at part 1.
Part 1.
Hear a conversation between a travel agent and a customer. The customer wants to book a coach ticket. First, you have some time to look at questions 1 to 7. Now we shall begin. You should answer the questions as you listen, because you will not hear the recording a second time. Listen carefully.
Good morning. I'd like to book a coach to London. I was hoping you had something available this Saturday afternoon.
Good morning, sir. Take a seat and I'll just check for you. Yes. We still have several free seats for Saturday. Where will you be leaving from? There are three pickup points in town: Main Street, Centenary Square, or the Central Bus Station.
From Centenary Square, please. That's easier for me to get to than the bus station.
And what time would you like to leave? There are coaches on the hour every hour, from 12 through till 6 p.m.
Well, I'm meeting someone at the station in London and I need to be there for 4:30. So, which one would you recommend?
Well, there's one leaving at 1 that arrives at Victoria Station at 4:10, if that's any good. Traffic is usually quite light at the weekend and the drivers tend to make good time, so I think you'd certainly be there for 4:30.
OK, that sounds just right. I think I'll take that. I can always phone ahead if I'm going to be late.
And when are you returning, sir?
Actually, I'm not sure when I'll be coming back, so I won't book a return ticket, just one way.
I can always book you an open return if you'd like. You can use this at any time within the next month, as long as you contact us first to reserve a seat.
Well, there's a chance I might be getting a lift back, you see, so I'll just pay for one way. I don't want to buy a return if I don't need it.
OK, no problem. Are you travelling alone?
Just the one ticket, please. I'm going down to visit my daughter at university. My son's meeting me at the station, so it's a proper family reunion.
Very nice. OK, well, I can book that for you if you like, sir. That'll be £23.50. Now, I just need to take down some details. Can I have your name, please?
Yes, it's Matthew Upton. That's U-P-T-O-N.
And your address?
34 Allesley Road. Allesley. That's A-L-L-E-S-L-E-Y.
And your telephone number?
01732-558-997.
And your email address? We'll use this to send confirmation of your travel details.
matt257@yahoo.co.uk.
OK, thanks.
Before you hear the rest of the conversation, you have some time to look at questions 8 to 10. Now listen and answer questions 8 to 10.
Before I forget, I'll be taking a little luggage. Is there a set luggage allowance?
We offer a very good luggage allowance. You can take 2 suitcases as long as they're no more than 20 kilos each. That's 40 kilos in total, and 1 small item of hand luggage on the coach. Most people find that more than adequate. Any additional items carry an extra charge of £10 for each bag.
I certainly won't be taking that much, so I should be okay. I was worried I might be taking too much.
Would you like travel insurance included with your ticket? It's an additional £2.
No, I don't think so.
No problem. It's not compulsory. Okay. How will you be paying?
Actually, I've been having trouble with my debit card today, and I've left my chequebook at home, so I'd better pay in cash. You'll give me a receipt, won't you?
Certainly, and we'll send confirmation to your email address as well. So that's £23.50, sir. If you just wait a minute, I'll print you off a receipt.
That is the end of part one.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now turns to part two.
Part two.
You will hear a presenter on a radio phone-in show. The presenter is talking to a woman who was bitten by a poisonous spider.
First, you have some time to look at questions 11 to 15. Now, listen carefully and answer questions 11 to 15.
Today, we're continuing our Traveller's Tales. On the line we have Amanda Toddington, who had quite a nasty experience in Australia last year. Isn't that right, Amanda?
Yes. My husband and I were on holiday and we were staying at a friend's house on the coast near Brisbane. It was towards the end of the holiday and I was about to go into the garden and enjoy my breakfast. I walked out into the kitchen, slid my left foot into my shoe and felt a tiny sting. It was pretty painless, but I shook the shoe off my foot and saw this tiny spider running out as the shoe hit the wall. Anyway, not being an expert, I presumed the worst, that I'd been bitten by something that was going to kill me, and I completely lost control. I don't think I've ever screamed so much in all my life. We'd been told beforehand to always check our shoes before putting them on, as it's a common way to get bitten. So I suppose it was my own fault, really.
So what was it that had bitten you?
Tony, that's our Australian friend, he immediately asked me if I knew what had bitten me, and I pointed to the corner of the room where I'd last seen the spider. He picked up a jar and found the creature in the corner where the shoe had hit the floor. "It's a redback," he said, and he gently placed the jar over the spider. The funny thing was, we'd been talking about some of the creatures we needed to be careful of a few days previously, and as he said the name redback, the conversation came flooding back to me. In particular, the fact that the bite can be extremely painful. I've found out since that the redback is from the same family as the black widow spider, and it's the female that does the damage, which it turned out was what I'd been bitten by.
You must have been absolutely petrified.
You can say that again. I remember feeling quite confused. I wasn't in a great deal of pain to begin with, and yet I could see from our friends' faces that they were concerned. Tony explained that the venom or poison of the bite spreads quite slowly, so the pain doesn't feel too bad at first. Gwen, Tony's wife, brought an ice pack, and Tony held it against the bite to make it less painful. Apparently, you're not supposed to put a bandage on the area, as this can make it hurt even more. Tony tried to put my mind at rest by explaining that this was quite a common bite, that the hospital would have an anti-venom and that everything would be okay. But I was beginning to panic. We were flying back to the UK the next day, and I really didn't know what to do.
Before you hear the rest of the talk, you have some time to look at questions 16 to 20. Now listen and answer questions 16 to 20.
So, what did you do?
Well, Tony phoned the doctor, who told him to check my symptoms for the next hour or two. As time went on, the pain became very intense, from my foot right up to my knee. My husband was on the internet and was reading out the possible symptoms. I wasn't feeling sick, and I hadn't yet developed a fever. But I had a terrible headache and my foot was beginning to swell up. At this point, Tony decided to take me to the local hospital to be on the safe side. I really didn't want to go, as I had visions of being kept in for days and all our plans being spoilt. But Tony and my husband insisted. When we got to the hospital, I was relieved to see how casual everyone was when Tony explained I'd been bitten by a red-backed spider. They told me to take a seat and got on with their work.
And did you receive any treatment?
By the time I got to see a doctor, the pain was very intense indeed, and I was getting quite upset. The doctor decided to give me a dose of an antivenom, which he assured me would eventually deal with the problem. Unfortunately, he also explained that it wouldn't have an immediate effect, and the symptoms might last for several days. But the story has a happy ending. My husband managed to book us onto another plane 1 week later. And even better news was that the symptoms of the bite finally cleared up after about 24 hours. Within a couple of days, I was back to normal again. So thanks to the spider, we managed to extend our holiday by a week.
That is the end of part two.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now turns to part three.
Part three.
You will hear a conversation between two university students about transferring to a different course.
First, you have some time to look at questions 21 to 26. Now listen carefully and answer questions 21 to 26.
Hi, Graham. How are you doing?
Hi, Judy. I'm fine, thanks. And thanks for popping round. I was hoping I could pick your brains about transferring to another course.
Yes, I remember you saying you wanted to do something else. Are you planning on staying here, or are you looking to go to a different university?
No, I'm happy to stay here. I just feel I need to do something else. How did you go about your transfer? You did History of Art originally, didn't you?
That was the course I initially wanted to transfer to. I'd studied art at college and wanted to continue, but my parents persuaded me that English would be more useful, so I took their advice. But I really didn't enjoy it and tried to transfer to History of Art, but the course was full. Anyway, I spoke with the course tutors and they told me about the fine art programme. They thought I had the talent to do it, so that was that.
I see. How did your parents take the news?
They were okay about it, really. They just want me to do what I enjoy, so everything's fine there. So you're hoping to transfer as well, then?
Yes, I think I've given the German course a good try, but I'm not really happy. Most of the other students on the course seem to have at least one German parent, or they've spent a great deal of time in Germany, so their German is much better than mine. We get huge novels to read, and I'm still struggling with the first chapter while they're already finished and writing their assignments. I thought about doing a combined degree, German with another course, as the workload would be less, but in the end, I feel a complete change would be best. One of my other subjects at school was history, and I realise now I'm actually more interested in that. One of my housemates is doing history, and it sounds like a great degree, so I've decided to focus on that.
Well, people do transfer, so it's not out of the ordinary. But won't you miss the opportunity to study abroad for a year? You spend year three in Germany, don't you?
I know. Not only Germany, actually. You have a choice of Germany, Switzerland or Austria. That would be exciting, I know, but that's really the only thing I like about the course. And I can always do some travelling after I've finished my studies. I still don't know what I want to do as far as a career is concerned, so I think it's best I study something I enjoy first and foremost. Anyway, I thought I'd ask you about how you went about your transfer before taking it any further.
Before you hear the rest of the conversation, you have some time to look at questions 27 to 30. Now listen and answer questions 27 to 30.
Well, the first thing you have to do is make sure you're clear in your own mind why you want to transfer. You'll need to persuade people that it's a good idea, so get your arguments clear. Then, I'm sure you've already done this, but check what the entry requirements are for history and whether you've got the necessary qualifications. They might be more flexible now you're actually here, but you need to show them you'd be able to keep up with your studies.
Well, I've got history qualifications, so I'm hoping that won't be a problem. Who do I have to speak to?
Well, they always tell you to speak with your course tutor first, in case there's a way of making the course you're on more appealing to you. But it sounds like you've definitely decided to get out, so I'd go to the careers service next, just to make sure there aren't any restrictions on transferring. It shouldn't be a problem, but it's best to check first. And then there's your funding. I'm no expert, but I would imagine this won't be a problem. German's a four-year course and history is three, so you could just start from year one next September. If the career service think it's okay and there are no funding problems, go and speak to the admissions tutor in the history department, just to see if they're happy with your qualifications and if there are places.
Okay. Well, I'm hoping it'll be okay. I'm planning to transfer at the beginning of next year rather than halfway through this year.
Yes, hopefully it'll be all right. If they accept you, it's pretty straightforward after that. It's not like you're going to another university. You just have to complete a form. I think it's called an internal transfer form. Your current head of department and the one for the course you're transferring to have to add their signature as well, and that's it.
Well, thanks for that, Judy. I'd better start making my case for transferring, I suppose.
That is the end of part three.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now turns to part four.
Part four.
You are going to hear a lecturer giving a talk about whale migration. First, you have some time to look at questions 31 to 40. Now listen and answer questions 31 to 40.
Today we're going to continue our investigation into the use of technology in plotting oceanographic migratory patterns. And I'd like to focus specifically on creatures that we didn't even realise existed until very recently. Pygmy blue whales. In particular, I'd like to talk about a high-tech method of tracking that researchers have used to find out more about these creatures. Pygmy blue whales, which are one of several subspecies of blue whales, spend their lives in the vast expanses of the Indian and Southern Pacific Oceans. They were first identified as a distinct subspecies in 1966. Before then, they were probably confused with the Antarctic or true blue whale, so it's only recently that researchers have started to learn about them and their migrations to and from their breeding and feeding grounds. Scientists are interested in pygmy blue whales because, although they are a very mobile subspecies, very little is known about their movements and their populations. Large-scale movements of whales are particularly hard to study, and what we do know about pygmy blue whales, we've mainly learned from examining whaling records. There are several populations of pygmy blue whales in the southern hemisphere and two main feeding grounds off southern and western Australia. Scientists were interested in testing their hypothesis that the pygmy blue whales feeding off western Australia migrate to Indonesia to breed. To track the whales' movements, researchers made use of something called satellite telemetry. This refers to the use of a satellite-linked tag attached to a whale. When the antenna on the whale breaks the surface of the water, the tag communicates with a satellite system. The location of the whale can be determined when multiple satellites receive the tag's transmissions, much like how the navigation system works on a mobile phone. Researchers receive this location data in almost real time via the project website, which allows them to track the movement of the tagged whale from many miles away. The use of these tags has enabled researchers to discover that pygmy blue whales do indeed travel northwards from the west coast of Australia in March and April, reaching the warmer breeding grounds of Indonesia in June. They remain there until September, at which time they then return to Australian waters. In addition to identifying the migratory pattern of this particular population of pygmy whales, research has also shone new light on the whales' feeding patterns. It's usually assumed that whales go without food outside of the summer, when they leave their feeding grounds. But interestingly, the pygmy blue whales studied travel from productive feeding grounds off Western Australia to productive areas in Indonesia, and therefore probably still have the opportunity to feed whilst they're in their breeding grounds. It is hoped that mapping the migratory movements of the pygmy whales will help conservation efforts for these endangered animals. And the study has enabled researchers to identify specific conservation issues. For example, the migratory routes of pygmy blue whales correspond closely with shipping routes. Consequently, researchers are keen to monitor whether this has any negative effects on the whale's behaviour. Baleen whales, these are whales that use filters to feed, not teeth, use sounds to communicate and to gain information about their environment. Clearly, as pygmy blue whale movements correspond to shipping routes, there is potential for the noise generated by ships to affect communication and hence social encounters and feeding. Previously, researchers could only hypothesize that pygmy blue whales occupying Western Australian waters travelled into Indonesian waters. Now that this hypothesis has been borne out by evidence, conservation efforts can be undertaken in a wider area than just Australian waters. However, scientists aren't stopping here. A question mark still remains over the movements of the pygmy blue whales that utilise the feeding grounds further south, off the southern coast of Australia. Genetic evidence indicates that there is a mixing taking place between the population of whales in the feeding grounds of Western Australia and the population further south. Researchers are keen to discover whether the pygmy whales from the southern feeding grounds follow a similar migration route to those from the west coast, or whether they migrate to the subtropical region to the south of Australia. As a result, there are plans to tag the pygmy blue whales further south in order to find out whether they move through the same areas as the western population and are therefore exposed to the same risks.
That is the end of part 4.
You now have half a minute to check your